Thank everybody for getting up nice and early to join us this morning. First place I want to start is, if you follow the news over the last course of the last year and even the last few weeks and months, Iran is obviously constantly in the news. It's in the crosshairs of the Trump administration. And I thought by presenting this talk at this conference, what we would try to do is actually provide a little bit of context, as Sophie laid out to start, because if you just rely on the news and what's happening, you're going to be left confused. You're going to be left in a state of bewilderment and not really understanding what's happening, what's actually underlying this conflict and its historical context, because those things are intentionally left out by the media, and because of the way that the media portrays events in our 24/7 news cycle, instantaneous gratification, clickbait type of environment in which we live in. And so the thing to actually walk away when you read the news is that it's intentionally meant to obfuscate the realities of the underlying dynamics. So you guys are all, congratulate yourselves. You're at a socialist conference. The whole idea of being at a socialist conference is to actually have a framework for understanding the world in a better way. And so to be able to counter the obfuscation. So the first place we start when we talk about international relations between states, from a socialist perspective, we have to talk about imperialism. We can't start anywhere else. Socialists have an immediate framework on how that's, so that's our sort of our base framework from where we go. And what is imperialism and how does it fit within capitalism is the first place I'm going to start here. And so people should understand capitalism is a world economic system. It's a system that's based on extraction, on expropriation, all around the world. And that is, the nations that were first to capitalist develop began looking for markets, resources, etc., all around the world to extend their reach, extract resources and wealth from all around the world, essentially to line their pockets, which is essentially what capitalism is. That is, the accumulation of wealth into one class in the world. And so what imperialism is when those bounds of capitalist development break through from the state, from the internal dynamics of a society, they spill over national boundaries, borders, and so on and so forth. And then the relations among states are actually defined by economic relations and military relations about extraction at the heart of the relations. It's economic competition among states, and that is competitions for markets, resources, etc. And the reason why we talk about imperialism before we start talking about any country, but more particularly any country in the Middle East, is because the world's most important commodity, the most important resource, is predominantly located in that region of the world, and that is oil. And you can't have an understanding of any of the politics internally, externally, amongst the states without having that framework to begin with. That is, imperialism exists. It's about extraction. It's about stronger states extracting resources, having access to markets for the purposes of capitalist accumulation. And in the Middle East in particular, it's about oil. It is who controls that and making sure that the world's most important commodity, the thing that actually drives the engines of capitalism, constantly is flowing, right? And why is that the case, right? It's the importance of oil and what it means, not just for economic modes of production in terms of our transportation and so forth, but military, right? You know, jets don't fly on solar power. They fly on oil, okay? And the importance of oil was obviously discovered, we'll take a step back. Oil was discovered in the Middle East in 1912 in Iran, British extraction of Iranian oil. That led to the transition militarily from coal-powered navies to oil-powered navies. That proved decisive in the First World War. As Churchill put it, the Allies rode to victory on a sea of oil. Right, that was the decisive shift in terms of the importance and centrality of oil. Another thing we'll come back to later on in terms of why the importance again is, before the start of the first Gulf War, I think it was the Undersecretary of State for the United States, I think his name is Lawrence Korb, said he had this famous quote. He said, "If Kuwait grew carrots, we wouldn't give a damn." So you understand again the dynamic that actually drives this between places. So. Iran, important because it's the first country in the Middle East in which oil was actually struck. The British struck it in 1912, again, decisive. But also taking a step back, you know, even before the advent of oil, in terms of you know, its importance and its centrality, Iran has, for the better part of the last century and a half, been in the crosshairs of imperialism of one sort or another, whether it was British, Russian, what have you. And the sort of the history of Iran and development, political development of Iran over the last century and a half has actually been defined by this relationship between what are the external threats of imperialism to Iran and what is its reaction to them. And one thing I try to help people understand, or at least I like to convey, is the fact that in Iran and its political development and vis-a-vis how the people view themselves internally, vis-a-vis this constant reality of this external threat, has been sort of the dynamic that has pushed the movements from below and the political dynamics of that society. So Iran has actually gone through about three revolutions in the last century. Most people don't know that. In 1905, there was a constitutional revolution in Iran, actually a pushback against all the concessions that the Qajar dynasty had been making to Western imperialism, the British imperialists in particular. And so there was a groundswell of movement and mobilization from below. And it established, for the first time in Iranian history, and actually the first time in the Middle East, a parliament that is a push for democracy, a push for accountability, for a government that actually represents, so that we could actually have a method internally of pushing back against the external threats. And so the 1905 revolution is significant in that extent. Fast forward to the post-World War II era, and you begin to see a wave of national liberation struggles, post-colonial struggles that erupt around the world. Iran is not immune from that. And so to understand the sort of 1953 and the importance of Mossadegh and the overthrow of Mossadegh. Mossadegh was a popularly elected member of parliament, became prime minister of the country, and he essentially took that opportunity to say that Iranian oil is our national wealth, and sought to renegotiate the terms of oil and how the British extract that from Iran. The British, of course, said, no, it's our oil, it's not your oil, despite the fact that it's under your ground. And so there was a crisis that precipitated there, and so Mossadegh obviously took the next logical step, was like, well, if you're not going to negotiate the terms of this deal, then we're going to nationalize oil. And of course, that created a major crisis for Western imperialism. It's like, wait a second, how dare you nationalize your own oil? What would that mean for the rest of the world and the rest of the countries? Like, that's a bad precedent to set. And so the United States, Britain, undertook the first sort of, what do you want to call it? It was the CIA MI6 led coup that led to the overthrow of Mossadegh, the reimposition of the Shah and the monarchy, because, you know, it's a lot easier to deal with a dictator than it is to deal with any sort of popular power, a popular representation. So that's important. And then you fast forward the dynamic of having the reimposition of the Shah, the destruction largely of democracy and movement from below, and you know, sort of the internal dynamics of development, of state-led development from the top. Fast forward in 1979, you have the Iranian Revolution, which actually overthrows the Shah of Iran. But of course, all of these things are driven by, again, external, the impact of imperialist countries wanting to have control over this most important resource. But an also important dynamic of that is that the Shah of Iran had largely, after the post-World War II era, been incorporated into the U.S. design for control of Middle East resources. That is, it was its enforcement arm of U.S. military might. So think of it as a little permanent aircraft carrier in the Middle East that does the bidding of the United States to keep the Arab states in check. Of course, that role now has fallen largely onto Israel to play that part, but before the revolution, that was the important role of it. And so there's a contradiction there. External, again, preventing internal development, the stifling political development from below, all of that comes to a head in 1979, and so you have a revolution that brought that question to a head, overthrows the Shah, and institutes a new revolutionary regime, which eventually the Islamists consolidate, and then you have what is now the Islamic Republic of Iran. And so it's important to now talk about what has been U.S.-Iran relationship since the revolution, because I think that is the dynamic that is continuing to unfold. Because I think the importance of the revolution is that for the first time it shook the foundation of what the United States felt was a stable relationship in its most important region. And of course, since the revolution, U.S. policy in the Middle East has been largely, you know, chaotic and reacting from one thing to another, and not really having that ability to the stability that it once enjoyed during that post-war era until the 1979 revolution. And so, from 1981 to 88, there was the Iran-Iraq War. The United States actually, armed, trained, provided intelligence to the Iraqi regime and its bloody war against Iran. But that wasn't enough. Of course, you had Iran-Contra. You had the Israelis selling arms to Iran. These are for the United States, funneling that money over to the war in Nicaragua against so forth. So there's that development that takes place. So that's important. And then, of course, then we fast forward. You have developments that take place. After that, there's the first Gulf War, in which the United States pushes back Saddam out of Kuwait and spends the next decade essentially through economic sanctions, ensuring a retrograde society that would prime for war after the 9/11 period. I'll take a minute to just talk about Iran's internal development since the revolution, because I think it's significant. It plays a huge part in understanding where we're at now from the perspective of Iran. As you can understand, the revolution takes place. There's a consolidation of the clerical regime in Iran. It's incredibly bloody. All the forces of the revolution are largely eliminated. The Iran-Iraq War precipitates a new consolidation and a wave of violence by the clerical establishment. And so after, and then coming after the end of the Iraq War, essentially Iran finds its place in a place where they're largely outside of the international economic system and wants to spend the next, the several decades since that time, largely finding a way to reintegrate itself into the world economy. Because Iran has primarily been, like many states in the third world or in the periphery, kind of like a one-trick pony, right? You have one primary resource that drives your engine for economic development, and you have a growing population, and there's got to be a way to diversify that economy. And so there's been nothing but attempts, largely by the Iranian regime, to be able to do so. And so you do actually see tremendous growth and a dynamic development internally economically in Iran, an intention to diversify its economy, to industrialize its base, to begin seeking trade relations with a number of states locally, regionally, and globally. But the relations with the United States, even though Iran made numerous overtures with the U.S. to try to develop that, has largely been stulted since the end of the Iran-Iraq War. And a large part of that has to do with the role of Israel. And the importance of that has to do with, in the mid-90s, when the Clinton administration was in power in the United States, there was a unique moment where, for Israel, its viability, its continued viability, is always predicated on the idea that it is a stage in siege. It is a state that exists in a constant stage of siege, right? It is a military outpost for sort of the West and the Middle East, and its entire viability relies on it continuing to be that thing. So there has to be a threat at all times for Israel to have to be able to thwart. After the end, up through the mid-90s, that threat was always Saddam Hussein. That was always Iraq. So that's important. But then when the first Gulf War ended, Saddam's capabilities were largely diminished. And so Israel needed a new threat. And the Clinton administration comes to Israel and says, well, now we're going to take this opportunity and you're going to finally make peace with the Palestinians. And so Israel made a choice and said, okay, that's fine. We'll make peace with the Palestinians, for Oslo, quote unquote, peace. But Iran is our new threat, despite the fact that during the Iran-Iraq War, Israel is the one arming Iran. And so then you begin the process of dual containment. That is, Iran is a threat to the United States. That threat, that sort of emergence in terms of foreign policy in the United States is solidified in the mid-90s under a Democratic administration. And so that is the formula that is established moving forward. So there's a number of overtures back and forth. Iran's trying to integrate itself into the world economy. It's being opposed by the United States because it's a lot easier to have a boogeyman in the face of Iran than it is to actually normalize relations. Why? You know, I think the most important thing is for the U.S. projection of imperialism, the necessity of Islamophobia, always having an enemy in the Middle East is a central part of that. There's also the indelible mark that the hostage crisis after the revolution left on the American psyche, 444 days, where nothing on the screen is just the fact that you've got, you know, this clerical establishment, you're seeing, you know, Islam, you know, so on and so forth. It begins, so it's a confluence of factors that make it to the point that there's no political cost to being a hawk against Iran and taking an oppositional point of view, and there's a serious political cost to be paid for taking a conciliatory point of view against Iran. And of course, everything changes after 9/11, right? 9/11 takes place, and now there's the war on terror. U.S. is taking its unipolar moment to actually establish itself or reestablish itself and set up a new paradigm in the Middle East, and that becomes important because you know, first there's the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. An important thing to understand about that is the U.S. would not have been able to actually be able to defeat that regime in a very quick way and decisive way that it had if it was not for Iran's support and its backing of the Northern Alliance, which had been its ally against the Taliban. And so they actually facilitated that conversation between the U.S. and the Northern Alliance, thinking that if we participate in this process, we'll have a foot in the door and be able to have a new set of relations. Because why it's important? Because they saw the writing on the wall. If they're going to invade Afghanistan, we're next, so let's change this dynamic. Nothing really came of that. And so then you have the, you know, axis of evil speech by Bush, and then you have the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And then it became very clear to the Iranian regime, we're next. And, you know, as the saying went in Washington, you know, was it real men go to Tehran? And so it was very clear to the Iranian regime that they were next in the crosshairs. And so they consciously, within the political class, made a decision to actually go right wing. This is the change from Khatami presidency, which sought a dialogue of civilization, the reintegration of Iran, one wing, sort of the reformist wing of the political class in Iran. That is immediately crushed as a result of 9/11, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, and then you get the transfer of political power over to the conservative right-wing establishment within Iran, solidification of the military-industrial apparatus. Why? Because now there's an existential threat. You've got the U.S. in Afghanistan, you've got the U.S. in Iraq, we're next. How do we undermine this? And so, of course, you know, based on that calculus is the reason why Iran participated in the anti-occupation military actions that existed in Iraq against U.S. forces, arming various things like the Badr brigades, other brigades of the paramilitary forces that fought against the U.S. in the Shia-dominated areas of Iraq. And so the idea was, if you destabilize the situation and bog them down in Iraq, they can't come after us. And that largely succeeded. And so, obviously, the war drags on. 18 years later, we're still mired in Afghanistan, the United States is, and you know, Iraq is somewhat stabilized. But the entire Middle East is really not in control. If anything, the United States overplayed its hand and is unable to actually establish the sort of Pax Americana in the Middle East that it expected. And so it's been an absolute disaster for U.S. foreign policy. And rather than weaken Iran, it's actually emboldened Iran to a great extent in establishing its network throughout the Middle East and its relationships, largely driven by the defensive posture. Again, if you're about to be invaded, what are you going to do to make sure that that doesn't actually take place? So I think that's incredibly important. But of course, the Obama administration took a very different tack because obviously the price that was being paid in the constant deployment of U.S. forces and being on a military-ready basis in the Middle East was a price they weren't willing to pay. And for them, the reality was your economic and military competition is actually China. That's what the whole pivot to Asia under the Obama administration was like. We are mired in the Middle East. There's a zero-sum endgame. We're not willing to pay this price anymore. We need to transfer operations over, pivot, utilize our military and economic forces to take on what is our future existential enemy. And so largely there was a sort of a thawing. That's, you have to understand the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action within that context, as an ability to move away from crisis in the Middle East to be able to reallocate your forces and your orientation somewhere else in the world. And so that's how to understand why the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action came. It was a way to actually establish a sort of peace, lay a foundation for future cooperation, so on and so forth, because of that long-term U.S. imperial ambition. But of course, that's one wing of the U.S. political class had that view. Another wing of the U.S. political class was opposed to any deal with Iran at all costs. Again, the hawks and the and again, because this is about, there's never been a question about U.S. political aims, like the project of imperialism. This question is always about how do you go about best to attain those goals, right? And so, you know, one wing says this, the next wing that comes to power says something completely different. Says, no, actually, this is a horrible deal, and we want to get out from under it for ideological purposes, right? This is an ideological shift for the current rulers of the United States. And I think that's important, and that, I think, underlines that that justification. And the last place I'm going to go to is understanding what this shifting, right, the shifting from sort of the different wings of the political apparatuses in the United States, the different wings of the political apparatuses in Iran, is that these things are constantly playing against each other, and the people who actually suffer are the Iranian people. 80 million people in Iran are largely at the whims of two ruling classes that actually don't have the Iranian people's interests at heart, and they never have, and they never will. Obviously, imperialism prevents that from being the case, and so everything that we've seen, internal shifts in the political dynamics in Iran, is largely driven by the external stuff. So every time the U.S. threatens Iran, that means the mullahs at home crack down on dissent, crack down on movements, crack down on anything from below that could be seen as a threat to them in any way, shape, or form. And now Iran is an incredibly dynamic society. There's been social movements from below, workers' movements. I mean, it's like the strike activity in Iran just puts the strike activity in the United States to shame. It's just an ongoing developed thing. Again, women's movements, movements for of national minorities, ethnic minorities in Iran. These things are vibrant things. All these things get stifled when you're stuck in this cycle of military competition, political competition between the United States and Iran. And so I think that's the important thing that I wanted to focus on, is some of that history, some of this development vis-a-vis Iran and the United States. I think the next thing that we'll transition to is really understanding, while we may not be in a shooting war yet, war has already actually undertaken between Iran and the United States, and it's an importance to understanding that that's the reality, because I think then it'll define what is the next steps for us in this country to be able to actually lay out a framework, because right now the political class in this country does not have a way forward. All paths alternative to a shooting war taking place are largely being closed off, and it feels like it's an inevitable march toward this conclusion. So we need to understand where we're at now, what does the sanctions actually mean, and then in wrapping up, we'll talk about what are the next steps and the things that we can take. Thank you.
Thanks, Behzad. While someone, Sapere, our second speaker, is getting ready up here, I wanted to make sure those who came in late, first there's some seats scattered, so you know, don't hurt yourself, come on forward. And if you did not get a packet, these are slides that are intended to perhaps give you some visual assistance in understanding the second part of our presentation. So, we cool? Yeah? So, yeah, packets, I'll just... I'll come around and pass them around. Okay. Oh, thanks, Alice. Okay, she's got it. Thanks.
Thank you for being here. I'm going to start with talking about it, just laying out a couple of things I want to talk about. Behzad talked about the question of development and paths of development. And that's one of the things I'm going to try to hit and underline in terms of questions of sanctions and how that actually distorts and disrupts those paths. The second thing that I want to raise, which is the question of ruin and devastation, because I think that actually the question of ruin and devastation is something which has become much more prominent in the neoliberal world, and is actually not just a thing that happens, but has become much more of a tactic and a strategy. And I want to actually bring that into the discussion. The third thing that I wanted to kind of as a subset of that and want to raise is that the question of destruction is a B plan, is an alternative to regime change. something. And that's how the question of sanctions as a different path to destruction is so prevalent and nefarious and important to actually pay attention to. And hopefully I have time to talk a little bit about something else at the end, which is the question of the Green New Deal, which this actually does have an impact on. In any case, if you...
Can I actually grab one of the packets?
Thanks, Allison.
Thank you.
Here you go.
If you actually walk through the packets, the first thing that... this kind of came to me when Notre Dame was burning. And there was... people were in shock. Yet within days, there were billions of dollars that were being given to rebuild Notre Dame. And I was in shock. Like, oh my God.
Right.
But the thing that made me think of is that another World Heritage Site, which is not just a building, but a city, the old city of Sana'a in Yemen, was being daily bombarded by Saudi airplanes with US and UK bombs. And the first couple of pictures you see is the old city and what's left of it. And that doesn't even take into account the human cost of it. Okay. The second thing for me that came to mind was the question of Palmyra. I don't know if people are actually familiar with Palmyra. And this one was actually not by Saudi Arabia, it was blown up by ISIS. And then the question arises, how is it that Syria, which if you look at it in the over the past 50 years, Syria and Iraq, or take any metric basically, primary, secondary, tertiary education enrollments, life expectancy, if you look at it, were some of the most developed countries in the region. Go in the 1960s and 1970s, they were actually ahead of Iraq under the Shah. They go from that to becoming the breeding ground for ISIS, Islamic States of Iraq and Syria. And that question of what has happened kind of underlies in the region is the question of the destruction, which I want to raise with you, and in terms of what's going on. If you look at the slides, you can take a look at the Syria destruction, and first thing that you see, it's very clear, 75% of the Syrian economy has been destroyed in the civil war. To put it in context, Germany and Japan had their economies destroyed to the tune of 66% and 52%. Germany with carpet bombing, Japan with two atomic bombs dropped on it. Syria at 75%. That is the level of destruction we're seeing in that country. And that is the basis of what we are talking about in terms of what happens to a society which is completely torn apart, the fabric is destroyed, that there is nothing left of it which then allows something like ISIS to come to the fore. The place I want to go with this is actually to step back to this, the 60s and 70s, which is Behzad actually talked about in terms of the wave of the national liberation movements in the world over. And it's not just in the Middle East, it's everywhere. Assad is part of that. You have to keep in mind, keep in context, we have the Chinese Revolution, we have the Cuban Revolution, Vietnam. We have the rise of national liberation movements, the FLN in Algeria, the victory in Algeria. We have basically a whole slew of national liberation movements in Africa, Lumumba, and then you have the rise of, in a different form, and probably in a more muted way, of some of the same sorts of aspirations in the Arab world. You have the rise of the Arab nationalist governments in Syria, in Iraq, Qasem. You have the same thing in Mossadegh in Iran. You have the rise of Nasser in Egypt. You are basically talking about a series of regimes coming to the fore who have as their heart these questions: independence, a break with imperial controls, development, development on a path independent from what is forced onto you, And the question of what kind of development which will ensure that independence. So it's not just any development, but the question of national development, import substitution. There's a whole set of stuff that I'm not going to get into, which actually go into that way of thinking. Not going to go through the history of it, but because of the distortions, you see basically the distortions of, you know, the air, this comes to a dead end. You see the distortions and the of this in terms of the degeneration of the that project in Iraq and Syria into the form of the Ba'ath Party in both countries, different rival Ba'ath parties. You see in terms of Egypt, with the death of Nasser, the flipping of Egypt from being on the other side to becoming a pro-US ally under Sadat. So you have basically a breaking down of that, which coincides with actually the time where you're seeing the neoliberal project being imposed. Also here, that starting in the 70s and going later. Iran is the aberration. Iran is the breaking the other direction, is the closing of that whole period. 79, it's important to see it as that aberration, as a leftover, the 79 revolution. In any case, from another perspective, however, we're looking at the past couple of decades, really, in terms of a perpetual war by the U.S., which Bessa talked about. However, what we're dealing with is not the same sort of a thing that we had before. We're dealing with wars and regime changes, in a sense, which are not the same as before. In the past, you could get rid of Mossadegh and put the Shah in place. In the past, you did get, and this is really the last time that the U.S. has done this, could get rid of the Allende regime and put Pinochet in power, which was, by the way, the beginning of the new liberal experiment. The regime changes today are not to put your own person in power. It is to get rid of what's there. And so it leaves this vacuum. This is seen partly as a weakness of the U.S., which has created the chaos that we're seeing and the destruction. But what I want to say is that actually, maybe we should change our lenses in terms of how we look at this. Because there is another path that's being followed, which actually matches the time, which is that you don't necessarily have to put your person in power. The question of destruction, weakening of the states, breaking them up, if they were strong states, but on the other side, is actually a very, very viable alternative. Nation building takes time. Nation building is not the forte of neoliberalism. Destruction is. And that's kind of what we're seeing take place in the area. Bessa mentioned Bolton, real men want to go to Tehran. And we start thinking about it. You know, okay, they want to do regime change, bring their own person in place, et cetera, et cetera. That's not how it works out. Nobody wants to go to Tehran. Bolton doesn't want to go to Tehran. Who are they going to put in the place? The monarchists? The Mujahideen Khat?
Yes.
They're going to be running that that government? They're not. It's impossible. They're hated in Iran. They were penned in their own camp in Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein to be protected from both the Iraqis and the Iranians. It just will not happen. However, the path of a destruction of a strong state in the area, which is standing up to the US, absolutely is in the cards. So the question of what I want to introduce in terms of terraforming, how do you change the terrain from above, is very important in terms of our discussions. Okay, what terraforming is about this. Number one, it's from above. You can do it with a few bombs. It has a very, very small, low military footprint. That's an advantage. The weapon of choice is actually siege and sanctions, economic. Number two, it destroys the internal bottom-up organic opposition as society is ruined. The working class, youth movement, women's movement, all of these are basically pushed back and destroyed as civil society comes apart, as the society is militarized. Okay. Number three, it's easy pickings. fragmentation. Neoliberalism loves fragmentation. Isolation and fragmentation. It's like the weather forecast these days. Isolating, scattered thunderstorms. It's like, that's not the weather, that's the world. Anyways, they love fragmentation. And when you have fragments, you can manipulate them, you can cut deals with the fragments. And the bonus point of it is this, that if you have nationalized oil, you don't have to privatize. If you get rid of the nation and make it into fragments, cut a deal with every piece. It's a workaround issues that they have been grappling with over the question of privatization. Finally, terraforming, and this is the important part, is that if you actually it changes the balance of powers between the different countries in the region. If you destroy Syria, Iraq, and if you take Iran out of the picture in the same form, what you have managed to do is to create a swath of land which goes from the Mediterranean, the Gaza, all the way to Afghanistan, which is in ruins and fragments. The only sticking point is Iran, despite the nature of it. We're talking about power. What does that do in terms of the change in the balance of forces? It changes the balance of forces to a number of countries who are basically second rate in terms of powers, Saudi Arabia, Gulf, but also Israel. This is the terraforming we're talking about today. And the weapon of choice is actually sanctions. So on to sanctions. I just want you to go and look at some of the slides. I'll run through them very quickly. I'm not going to go through them in detail. You are taking these with you. A couple of things I just want to point out too. If you look at the Iraq GDP and the Iran GDP timelines, you'll see massive disruptions that take the growth and development completely out of its normal path. The Iranian one, you saw the Syrian one already in terms of the sanctions, the neoliberal projects in the page before that. In terms of Iran, exactly the same thing. War, but if you look at it, moving on to the next slide in terms of the GDPs which are tagged, you will see that the drop from 600 billion to 385 billion, which is from 2012 to 2015, those are the sanctions that were imposed by the Obama, Hillary Clinton, softer and gentler sanctions, not this last round. That had as big of an effect, if not a bigger effect, on the GDP of Iran than the war. Just to keep that in mind. Yet, if you do a comparison of Iran to the rest of the countries in the region, Iraq, Egypt, Israel, you see that it's still a big fish. It's actually a bigger GDP with the sanctions than Israel. And these are GDPs, not per capita, and I do that on purpose. We can talk about it later if you want. Moving on, you can also see a mix, though like Demsat said, diversification, a mix of what Iran exports. It's still, by and large, oil. Minerals are oil. There is no other minerals, I can tell you that. It's oil and gas. Okay, that's it. The brown says something in the color in that it's oil. So if you look at it, there was actually a push. There was diversification. By 2011, there was like $30 billion of that was in non-mineral, non-oil. From there down to after the sanctions, it disappears and it never comes back. So the question of development, getting off oil, diversification is blown apart during sanctions. It's not just the GDP drop, it's not a trade drop, but it's also a shifting to what is being traded. We see a shift from Europe to Asia. And if you look at the boxes in the next page, you see China basically goes from being some 6% to becoming, just in a couple of slides, 30% of the trade. The shift is also from things that were coming from Europe to Iran, which were machinery, parts for vehicles, manufacturing parts, production, to the last slide, which you'll see it in a big yellow swath. We have now become food dependent. A good quarter of our trade imports are food. So sanctions have made us food dependent, more dependent on oil. And if anybody remembers the Food for Oil program in Iraq, well, there it is. Give us your oil, we'll give you the food, but in economic terms. And then the other part of that is also luxury goods. Why do we need jewelry except for the corruption that the sanctions actually create? Okay? In any case, I'm going to move on from the slides and say a couple of things. A few things about other effects of sanctions. It doesn't just affect Iran, it's also a question of how it impacts Europe. It distorts trade. It actually pushes things towards China, so stop with the China bashing, right? Guess who's causing the shift? But in terms of some of the actual numbers of what it means on the ground, the currency has dropped to a third of its value in 2012. And then in this round, just this last year, it dropped to a fifth of its value from 2012. So today, it's 1/15th of what it was before 2012. Let me put it in context. If you're fighting for 15 and you win it, and you wake up tomorrow, your $15 is worth $1. Okay? That's what we're talking about. Inflation went up in 1 year some 20%. Medicine availability, 50% drop in 1 year of chemotherapy drugs. Half of the cancer patients can't get them. 40% drop in asthma medication. Factor VIII, which is used in hemophilia, has dropped 60% in 1 year. 2012, this is not now, this is 2012. This is Obama and Clinton, okay? Price average has gone up 50 to 70% in medication. 55% drop in imports of raw materials for medicine. They won't let the raw materials come in, okay? So let me give you a cycle of what goes on. One cycle illustrates the development track. Iran is has the fourth largest reserves of oil in the world. It is the sixth largest oil producer. It is also the sixth largest importer of refined gasoline. Despite that, the fact that in 1953, when the oil was nationalized, the Abadan refinery was the largest refinery in the world, today we cannot refine our own oil. Sell it to us, we'll sell to you the refining. That's the development trap. That's the cutoff for development. We have been relegated to becoming ditch diggers in the pedigree of world market. Dig the hole, give us the oil. That's your role, nothing else. We import 40% of the gasoline. This is the cycle. When the sanctions hit in 2012, because there was not enough gasoline, there was a flood of badly refined gasoline in Iran, which created, with lots of benzene in it, with lots of which spiked asthma, but cancer, a massive spike in cancer in Iran in after 2012. At the same time, we have the chemotherapy drugs that disappear, but more importantly, cobalt-61, which is radiotherapy, was sanctioned. It's radioactive. So you have actually a drop of radiotherapy machines in Tehran from 25 to 6. This is the cycle that we live in. Basically, sanctions are like a siege on a city. Just want to wrap up with 2 points. You're penned in. They're really good at penning in people and then letting them rot right now. Whether it's on a border, Gaza, or in Iran. They're penned in, you're as a siege penned in, and you're left there to starve. Your options are use your reserves. Once that runs in, tear the place apart to use it as fuel reserves, right, development goes. And then the last stitch is look for somebody from the outside, Europe, or make a run for it. Figure out a way to break the siege. That's why you see so many people in Gaza actually trying to break the siege by going for the fences. Iran's play on the nuclear development is breaking the siege, making Europe come to the help. You have to understand it in context. We don't need nuclear power in Iran. It's suited for wind and solar incredibly. UAE doesn't need nuclear power. Saudi Arabia doesn't. We don't. The only reason that we have actually ended up from oil to nuclear power is because we're trying to break our dependency on oil and we want to have a different path of development. Final point, Green New Deal. Green New Deal is about this. Just very summarizing. It's really about, it's a question of the climate crisis, right? It's about breaking the dependency on oil, coming up with a different path of development which actually gets you off of oil dependency. In the process, developing a national plan for development. In the process, trying to actually do that with different priorities for people. This is all I gotta say to you. Welcome to the fight. We've been doing it since 53. The only difference is this, that we've been doing it not as consumers. The international part that is incorporated into the Green New Deal is about how do you deal with impacted communities, right? Whether it's coal miners here, but the international places which are impacted by climate change. What about the producers? What about the people who have been relegated to ditch diggers? We've been fighting this fight. We need to start talking on an international level what it also means in terms of places like Iran. For us, from where we stand, the fight against climate change is no different from the fight against sanctions. You cannot develop differently and end our dependence on oil without fighting sanctions.